Israeli forces pull out of part of central Gaza.
Since the early months of the war, Israeli forces had occupied the roughly 4-mile-long corridor south of Gaza City that stretches from the Israeli border to the Mediterranean Sea.
The story of a Ukrainian soldier defending her homeland.
Yulia Mikitenko is the commander of a drone reconnaissance platoon on the front line in Donbass. She's 29 years old. She has, at the moment, actually about 35 men under her command.
And can the U.S. be the cryptocurrency capital of the world?
Trump's executive order directs a working group to consider creating a national digital asset stockpile.
Today is Monday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Beginning today in the Middle East, the families of the three Israeli hostages released from captivity on Saturday said their condition demonstrates the need for the remaining captives to be returned as soon as possible. The families spoke at two press conferences on Sunday at medical facilities where the trio are being cared for following their release by Hamas as part of an ongoing ceasefire deal. The former hostages appeared thin, weak, and pale, and in worse condition than the 18 other hostages already freed under the January agreement. In exchange for the hostages' release, Israel freed 183 Palestinian prisoners, some convicted of involvement in attacks that had killed dozens of people, as well as 111 who were detained in Gaza during the war. Also, in accordance with January's agreement, the Israeli military has withdrawn from an area of central Gaza. Fiona Jones of Reuters reports.
The Israeli military has withdrawn from Gaza's Netzarim corridor, an area that bisects the enclave. That's according to Hamas on Sunday. The move was expected, in line with the ceasefire deal between Israel and the Palestinian militants group. An Israeli security source also confirmed the military's withdrawal from central Gaza. Thousands of Palestinians have streamed through the passage in recent weeks, returning to their homes in the north from southern Gaza, where they had sought shelter from the war. Mohammed is among them.
We are steadfast, and we've been patient under the rockets and strikes. They have deprived us of food and water, but they haven't deprived us of air. We have stayed alive.
Some who crossed over have described their shock after seeing the destruction of communities, many of which have become a wasteland. Since the early months of the war, Israeli forces had occupied the roughly 4-mile-long corridor south of Gaza City that stretches from the Israeli border to the Mediterranean Sea. The corridor cut off Gaza's northern communities, including its largest metropolitan area, from the south. There was no immediate comment from Israeli military on the withdrawal. Hamas, who celebrated this withdrawal as a victory, deployed its police force to manage the flow of Gazans using the passage. Analysts say Hamas's increased public presence in Gaza since the ceasefire deal sends the message that the group has not been defeated. Israel has vowed to destroy Hamas for its October 2023 attack, in which 1,200 people were killed and over 250 taken hostage, according to Israeli tallies. More than 46,000 people have been killed by Israel's retaliatory assault, Palestinian authorities have said.
Reuters' Fiona Jones reporting. Shifting our attention now to Europe and the war in Ukraine. Ukraine is rich in some natural resources, particularly rare earth minerals, including lithium and titanium. U.S. President Donald Trump has suggested that American aid to Kyiv be in exchange for these critical elements. This as world leaders meet later this week in Munich to discuss, among other issues, the future of Kyiv's security. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky shows reporters a once classified map pinpointing the location of his country's rare earth and other critical minerals.
These deposits are priceless, huge amounts of money, huge. That's why we need to protect them. So if we're talking about a deal, that's what the Americans want, then let's do a deal.
U.S. President Donald Trump says he's open to negotiations.
So we're looking to do a deal with Ukraine where they're going to secure what we're giving them with their rare earth and other things.
Trump's National Security Advisor Mike Waltz on Sunday echoed the president's desire to recoup U.S. aid to Ukraine through the country's natural resources. Rare earth minerals are important for the manufacture of electric motors and consumer electronics. Zelensky says less than 20% of Ukraine's resources are under Russian occupation. But he calls Ukraine's Dnipro region very rich and warns that if Russia controls those mineral deposits, it could feed them to U.S. adversaries like Iran or North Korea. Targeting the area, Ukrainian drone operators launched strikes against would-be invading Russian forces along the Dnipro River. Zelensky says Russia knows the location of critical resources back from Soviet-era geological surveys. Zelensky also says he has discussed with Trump the idea of housing U.S. liquefied natural gas in Ukraine's underground storage sites. Back in Kyiv, it was another night of air combat, as Ukraine's Air Force says it shot down nearly half of 139 drones launched by Russia. No damage or casualties were reported by local officials. Meanwhile, German lawmakers last year approved a roughly $107 billion special fund to strengthen the country's military in response to Russia's war on Ukraine. The German army currently has around 179,000 troops, and according to AP, the country aims to reach 203,000 by 2031.
The situation in Europe has changed because of the war in the Ukraine. So now where whole areas are changing and we need to get ready for maybe a war in the future, we need to fill up our reserves.
Ready, go.
World leaders will meet this week at the Munich Security Conference in Germany to discuss, among other subjects, support for Ukraine. The talks run from February 14th through the 16th. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
In Arabasadi's story, he mentioned the Donbas region, one of the areas in Ukraine that President Volodymyr Zelensky said is rich with rare earth minerals. It's also where you'll find Yulia Mikitenko. She's the leader of a drone reconnaissance unit there. Mikitenko's story is a fascinating one, if a little sad. She overcame tremendous personal loss and struggled to find her way in the male-dominated military, but find her way she has. Her story is a hair-raising look at modern war, told by a veteran journalist and writer, Laura Marlowe. The book is called How Good Is It? I Have No Fear of Dying.
Yulia Mikitenko is the commander of a drone reconnaissance platoon on the front line in Donbass. She's 29 years old. She has, at the moment, actually about 35 men under her command. She's Ukrainian. She was born in 1995, just 4 years after independence in Ukraine. And she, while she was at university, she met a soldier and fell in love with him and married him 3 months later. That was in 2015. She married Ilya Serbin. And the following year, when she graduated from university, she joined the army to be with him. He was killed in a Russian bombardment in 2018. In 2020, her father self-immolated on the Maidan because he thought Zelensky was capitulating to Russia. She's one of the most, probably the bravest person I've ever met, and I've covered a dozen wars.
Well, that brings us into my next question. There are hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians fighting for their country. What is it about Yulia that made you want to tell her story?
I think it's partly that she's a woman, and I, somehow, for me, that made her more interesting. It's also that her life has really paralleled the life of Ukraine since independence. She knew the poverty of the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union. She was a leader at Maidan in the student protest. She was only 18 years old, but she co-founded a women's group on Maidan Square, demonstrating against Yanukovych, who was a Russian puppet. And she's lived through most of this war. So for me, it was also a way of telling the history of independent Ukraine, but through the eyes of one extraordinary woman. And I found her story both tragic and inspiring.
The book is called How Good It Is, I Have No Fear of Dying. Where'd the title come from? I would think a fear of dying would be a healthy thing to have in a war, no?
Yeah. Julia says a little fear is actually helpful, keeps you safe. No, the title is the first line of a very famous poem in Ukraine by a poet called Vasil Stus, who was a dissident poet. He died in a Soviet labor camp in 1985. And her father, who died, had a photograph of Vasil Stus in his wallet when he self-immolated. But it was true. This was certainly true of Yulia's husband, Ilya. He had no fear of dying, and he died for his country on the front line in Donbass. It was true of her father, who died to make a political point that he was against capitulation. It's definitely true of Yulia, who has spent much of the last 9 years on the front lines. And it's true of many, many millions of Ukrainians who are resisting Russian aggression, Russian occupation, and who are willing to die also for their country.
We've been talking about Yulia. Let's talk about you for a minute. You've covered war and wars for a long time. This is a unique way of doing it, to sort of tell the story of one person in that war and getting to the geopolitics from the individual going up, rather than looking at the big picture narrowing down.
I was very inspired by Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, which is a masterpiece about the First World War, and which indeed has been made into two or three movies, a Hollywood movie in the 30s and more recently a German one. But it really tells what war is like from the soldier's point of view. And I was striving to do something comparable for the Ukraine war. I think also that this is the first time that a book co-written with a woman in combat has told about a war from a woman's point of view. There may be other people who've done it, but I don't know of them. And I thought it would be very interesting to see it from that female point of view.
Do women experience war differently?
Good question. I asked Yulia that the first time I interviewed her, and she said, no, it's the same for men and for women. But actually, having covered all these wars, I think that they do experience it differently. Yulia admits that she is more compassionate towards her men than many of the male commanders. I think that women also have a harder time in war. For example, Yulia is tormented by the idea that she could be taken prisoner and be raped by the Russians. There are thousands of Ukrainian women who've been raped, and to her, that's worse than death. It's the thing she fears most. Men, well, they actually also rape men, but I think it's less of a danger for men, perhaps. So there are differences.
Along with military action, her military experience, did you discuss the politics of the war? Do you know how she and her comrades might feel about peace negotiations with Putin or President Trump's statements that a deal needs to be done?
Yes, we do discuss it. They actually were disappointed in the Biden administration. They felt that the Biden administration sent them too little, too late, time and time again. They had to wait. You know, had the United States given the weapons they needed in 2022, they might have defeated the Russians. That's one thing they feel very strongly. They are hopeful about the Trump administration. I fear possibly overly hopeful. But they feel that at last things are going to move. They think that they don't necessarily trust President Trump to make a good agreement on their behalf. They feel that Trump will make a deal on his own with Vladimir Putin. And they feel that this deal will not solve the problem. There's a hunch that it's just going to be a ceasefire. Trump says he's going to freeze the lines. And indeed, General Keith Kellogg, his special envoy for Ukraine, has said similar things. If it just freezes the line, that does not resolve the questions of reparations, of justice, of war crimes trials, of sanctions, And there's a fear that they'll get sold down the river, that basically they'll freeze the lines and then the Russians will come back for more.
Here in the United States, we have a new Secretary of Defense who previously said that women don't belong in combat roles. And while he's walked that back somewhat, my last question for you, what do you think Yulia would say to Secretary Hegseth if given the opportunity?
I know what she would say because I read his quotes to her and asked her, and she laughed and she said, that is exactly what the old generals in Ukraine who have a Soviet mentality because they fought in the Soviet army, that is exactly what they say. And she bitterly disagrees with it, but she's proving that Secretary Hegseth is wrong.
Laura Marlowe is a journalist based in Paris. She's the author of How Good It Is, I Have No Fear of Dying. It's a unique look at the war in Ukraine. Ms. Marlowe, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. A federal judge early Saturday temporarily blocked billionaire Elon Musk's government efficiency team and Trump administration political appointees from accessing government systems used to process trillions of dollars in payments. The judge in New York issued the order after a coalition of Democratic attorneys general from 19 U.S. states filed a lawsuit late on Friday, arguing Musk's Department of Government Efficiency has no legal power to access the Department of Treasury's systems. Musk, on X, called the ruling, quote, absolutely insane. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. is committed to continue to work with the Kenyan-led multinational security support mission in Haiti. Rubio spoke in the Dominican Republic, where he met with President Luis Abinader. He also confirmed that the U.S. has granted an exception that unfreezes financial aid contributed to the UN Trust Fund to help finance the Haiti security mission. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at the U.S. and some domestic politics, President Trump says he wants to make the United States the cryptocurrency capital of the world. Still in the early weeks of his second term, he's putting his plan into place. VOA's Michelle Quinn has the story.
In his first weeks in office, President Donald Trump took steps to keep his campaign promises regarding cryptocurrency. He nominated a crypto czar and appointed regulators who are friendly to the industry. He issued his own crypto coin, and he signed a cryptocurrency executive order. David Sachs is Trump's crypto czar.
Yeah, this is the crypto EO. We're going to be forming an internal working group to make crypto, to make America the world capital in crypto under your leadership.
Trump was skeptical of cryptocurrency during his first term, but he appeared to change his mind during the 2024 presidential campaign. Cryptocurrency firms contributed heavily to Trump's presidential bid. Cryptocurrency proponents celebrated Trump's early moves as a break from what they saw as a hostile approach from President Joe Biden's administration. Ben McMillan is chief investment officer with IDX Advisors. He spoke to VOA over Zoom.
The executive, you know, action and his comments along with it, I think were very much in line with what crypto proponents were looking for, with what they wanted. I do think it's a good pivot.
Trump's executive order directs a working group to consider creating a national digital asset stockpile from cryptocurrencies seized by the federal government as part of law enforcement actions. The order also ensures crypto firms' access to banking services. Crypto companies have complained that banks have denied them accounts, but some critics worry that breaking down firewalls between the banking industry and the crypto world comes with risks. Molly White is a cryptocurrency critic. She spoke to VOA over Zoom.
That has also been a major focus of the crypto industry, and I think is something we should be watching closely because of the risk of contagion from crypto markets, which are very volatile and prone to crashes.
The White House Working Group is expected to recommend regulations, says international business strategy professor Ravi Sarathy at Northeastern University. He spoke to VOA over Zoom.
And I think that would be really the value if we had clear regulation, but also regulation that's even-handed, that doesn't only support the digital currency entrepreneurs, but also, you know, takes into mind the need to protect consumers and investors.
If crypto is going to define the future,
In the coming months, Trump is expected to put more pieces of his cryptocurrency plan in place. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Turning our attention back to Eastern Europe. On Sunday, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have cut the cord, or the power cable, with Russia. Diane Toe of Reuters explains.
Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania celebrated on Sunday their new connections to European power, literally. The Baltic states said they had successfully synchronized their electricity systems to the continental grid one day after severing decades-old energy ties to Russia and Belarus.
Today, history is made.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen commended the move at a ceremony in Lithuania's capital alongside the leaders of the three countries.
These chains of power lines linking you to hostile neighbors will be a thing of the past.
The three Baltic nations disconnected on Saturday from the IPS-UPS network, established by the Soviet Union in the 1950s and now run by Russia. The complex switch away from the grid of their former imperial overlord was debated for years. It gained momentum after Moscow annexed Crimea in 2014 and invaded Ukraine in 2022. It's designed to integrate the Baltics more closely with the European Union and to boost the region's energy security. Latvia's energy minister was present for the symbolic moment when workers cut the wires in Vilaka, just by the Russian border.
The new beginning of the new system working, it's more independent, more secure, and what's most important, the system is fully in our hand, our responsibility.
The Baltic Sea region is on high alert following a string of power cable, telecom and gas pipeline outages since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. All were believed to have been caused by ships dragging anchors along the seabed. Russia has denied any involvement. The Kyiv-supporting nations stopped buying power from Russia after it invaded Ukraine, but have relied on the Russian grid to control frequencies and stabilize networks to avoid outages. For Russia, the decoupling means its Kaliningrad exclave, located between Lithuania, Poland, and the Baltic Sea, is now cut off from Russia's main grid and has to maintain its own system.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us. And back in the United States, Afghan refugees in the U.S. are expressing concern about their status as the Trump administration cracks down on illegal immigration. In California, immigration lawyers are stepping in to address these concerns and clarify the potential effects on their status. Fahim Siddiqui reports from Sacramento in this story narrated for us by Bezan Hamdard.
Nasima Rezai and her family fled Afghanistan in 2021 after the Taliban took power. They traveled through 11 countries over a year and a half to reach the United States. Now, 3 months after arriving, they are anxious about their future and worried they will be caught up in a U.S. crackdown on those who are in the country illegally.
Refugees might be pushed back and denied acceptance. This is a concern for everyone, including myself. It's a very difficult situation.
An executive order signed by President Donald Trump aims to stop immigrants from entering the country illegally and deport undocumented immigrants who are already in the country. It also suspends the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. Immigration lawyers met in Sacramento this month to discuss the order's impact. The nonprofit Global Emergency Response and Assistance in California hosted the panel. Executive Director Suleiman Rahil.
We try to bring our lawyers, particularly Afghan American lawyers, who have experience and worked in this area, to answer the questions of Afghans and provide them with factual information.
Immigration lawyers say those refugees who applied for asylum would not be deported unless the court rejects their cases.
I want to emphasize that, according to U.S. law, no one can be deported until their case is processed and the judge decides about their case.
Since the Taliban's 2021 takeover, about 180,000 Afghans have resettled in the U.S. However, the relocation of thousands of others was paused when President Trump suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program. Meanwhile, the Rezaeis wait in hope that their cases will be accepted so they can start their new life. For Fahim Siddiqui in Sacramento, California, Behzhan Hamdar, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.